Andrew McGahn's new novel tells the story of the orphan and the foreigner, nameless characters in an unnamed psychiatric hospital on an unnamed island beneath a volcano. Neither of these characters can talk, but they can communicate, at least with each other. And when their minds connect, they're capable of extraordinary feats, of travelling together deep into the bowels of the earth to observe the swirling of the magma, or up beyond the stratosphere to watch the planet turning on its axis, of witnessing fundamental natural forces, the wonders of a godless world. Or perhaps this is all madness. Perhaps the orphan is just hearing voices and suffering delusions, and the foreigner really is nothing more than a catatonic burns patient, immobilised in a hospital bed. Andrew McGahn, welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National.
Hello, Peter. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, these two, just describe these two central characters a bit more for us, the orphan and the foreigner.
Well, they came out really because when I was thinking about the book, as you said there, elemental forces is what I was really interested in. And I did spend quite a few days trying to work out if I could write a story where they were the only characters. Things like winds and storms and earthquakes were the actual characters and there were no humans involved.
Whatever. No people at all.
No, that was my original dream, but I literally couldn't make that work. So,
what, it became too hard to write or would have been too hard to read?
I couldn't even conceive of how you could do it, you know, have these sort of totally personality-less characters driving a book. It just didn't seem to be conceivable. Anyway, so then I thought of, firstly, of a character of the orphan, of someone who's completely out of tune with humanity, but is freakishly in tune with nature. So she's almost an elemental force herself. Or is it so, is so close to them that she understands them instinctively.
She can predict what everyone... She can't communicate. She can't talk to other people,
right.
And she can barely understand what people say to her.
Exactly.
She's not a patient in the hospital. She works in the hospital as a kind of orderly sweeping.
Yeah, she was sort of abandoned there and given a job sort of by the staff.
But she can predict the weather.
Yes, that's the first thing you know about her differently. Of course, you know, she's her perspective is unique, and it's from her perspective that the book is mainly told. And because of her sort of... The isolation of her mind gives a very unique way of looking at things. But yeah, the first strange thing you know is that she can predict the weather and things develop from there. And the other thing I thought was, the other way to play with elemental forces, I thought, and I have a special love for weird natural disasters and weird weather events, and I was looking for some way to use all them in the book. I thought the other main character would be a guy who is eternally being killed by natural disasters but coming back to life and getting increasingly angry and confused about why the planet's doing this to him.
And that's the foreigner.
That's the foreigner. So between those two and between their relationship was a chance to explore all that sort of stuff with the natural world that I was keen to get into.
I'd like you to just give a brief reading from the opening of the novel. And this is a point at which the foreigner arrives at the hospital for the first time.
Yeah. He's washed up on a beach, the foreigner. He arrives at the hospital. No one knows who he is. He's just a person who's washed up on a beach, apparently in a coma. No identification, no question of where he comes from. And when he arrives at the hospital, the orphan is straight away taken with him. And he examines him a bit himself. But this is the first situation where, after they've examined him, realised they can't cure him, they don't know what's wrong with him, they have to work out whereabouts in the hospital to keep him. To begin with, they put the foreigner in the catatonic ward. The orphan did not quite understand the word, but to her, these patients were the empty people, the ones with nobody inside them. And of all the back ward's inmates, they certainly resembled the foreigner most closely. One, for instance, was a woman who did nothing but sit and brush her hair for hours at a time, staring, even though she had long since brushed herself bald. Another was a boy who rocked back and forth ceaselessly on his bed, his arms clasped around his knees. Others simply slept all day or gazed blindly at the ceiling, almost exactly as the foreigner himself did. None of them, beyond the occasional incoherent mutter or cry, ever spoke. But things changed after the foreigner moved in. Over the following days, the woman with the brush began to rake her skull so severely that blood was drawn. The boy's rocking gradually became so violent he repeatedly threw himself to the floor. And the others started to moan and shout hoarsely from the depths of their sleep. The nurses were alarmed. What was happening? It was only when they noticed that things quietened down abruptly if the foreigner was removed, when he was taken to the shower, say, that they came to wonder if he might be the cause. True, he hadn't moved or spoken in all that time, or done anything blameworthy. But there was something strange about him, they all agreed. Those beautiful eyes. The old doctor scoffed at the idea. He told the nurses that most likely the other catatonics didn't even know the foreigner was there. But if they really wanted to move him somewhere else, then he wouldn't stop them. This time they put him in with the geriatrics. It was another ward that was usually sleepy and subdued, for only the very old ended up there. Many of the inmates weren't even all that mad. They were just too infirm to survive on their own and had no one else to look after them. Others, however, had retreated into deep senility. They drooled, they leered, they smiled and laughed, and sometimes they yelled and cried, but mostly, thanks to the pills they were given morning and night, they dozed in silence. The foreigner, admittedly, was too young to belong there, although exactly how old he was no one knew. With his smooth, burnt skin, he didn't look any particular age. Not young, but not old either. In any event, he had a peculiar effect upon the geriatrics. One old man complained that he was not getting any sleep because the foreigner was climbing out of bed and dancing all night. Other patients concurred, but the orphan knew it wasn't so. She checked the ward regularly on her evening rounds, and the foreigner never moved. His bedclothes were never even ruffled. Then one morning, an old woman, a vague, timid creature who had never made any sort of fuss, was discovered completely naked upon the foreigner's bed, legs astride his hips, shuddering back and forth in delight. When she was dragged away, she insisted that he had lured her there and possessed her with his eyes, and that she would love him till she died. But even while she was on top of him, the man had remained as limp and unconscious as ever. That was enough for the nurses. Clearly the foreigner was a devil, that word again, of some kind. They wanted him shifted once more. The old doctor was doubtful. It didn't matter what the old people claimed, he said. They were mad, they imagined things. But the nurses insisted. Of course, they weren't educated people like the old doctor. They were just working women from the towns, full of strange stories and superstitions. But the hospital couldn't run without them, and so some way had to be found to keep the foreigner quietly out of the way. One option was to lose him among the general community, the everyday mad folk who made up the bulk of the hospital's inmates. But those wards were chaotic places, full of yelling and running and wrestling. And in fairness, no one thought they were a fitting home for a man who was bedridden and immobile. Someone then suggested the locked ward. Usually, only violent patients were sent there, to be kept in individual cells, with barred windows and with strong male nurses on hand. Still, the foreigner would certainly be out of the way. Indeed, the orphan would never have seen him again. But the nurses protested. If he had disturbed the otherwise peaceful catatonics and geriatrics so much, what might result if he was placed in proximity to inmates who were already aggressive and unstable? Somewhere he would do no harm. That's where he had to go. In the end, they settled on the crematorium.
Andrew McGahn reading from his novel Wonders of a Godless World. This is a book show on ABC Radio National. I should add that the crematorium is the name given to a disused furnace, and the foreigner is accommodated there next to four other patients who also become significant in the book, and who also, like the foreigner and the orphan, have no names: the Duke, the Witch, the Archangel, and the Virgin. Now, in that passage, the foreigner is referred to as a devil, but he also has Christ-like qualities. I mean, he calls on the orphan in a way, the orphan calls on him for proof of her belief in him, like a kind of doubting Thomas.
Well, he certainly keeps getting resurrected, so there's a Christ-like thing there. I never thought of him as so much as Christ-like. I've heard people say that the orphan is more of the Christ-like figure because she sacrifices herself sort of later on in the book to a degree. I never was thinking of religious overtones as I wrote it.
But she's constantly being tempted by the foreigner.
Yes, which I think would make him more of the devil, if anything, because he offers her, you know, the world effectively, and she has to try and work out what is he really offering and can he be trusted.
Mm. There's a kind of Faust-like element to the story. Was that conscious?
I come from a Catholic background, so there's got to be something in my head there of good and evil and those sort of concepts. But I really wasn't trying deliberately to think of that. I was more thinking of a Flying Dutchman type character, you know, who if in one of the, you know, the original version of the Flying Dutchman, the Flying Dutchman curses God and therefore is doomed to live eternally. I was thinking more that he's someone who curses nature. Like, I've always pictured the Flying Dutchman as a man in the storm, cursing the storm, daring the storm to kill him, and being forced to live immortally after that as punishment for his arrogance, you know, challenging the gods, challenging nature, whatever. So I saw the foreigner more as that sort of figure, who in his rage against nature is doomed to keep on being killed by nature, but also never to die.
So we've got a kind of Greek underworld type, having your entrails constantly eaten out by crows or constantly rolling a stone up a hill.
All that sort of stuff is there. All those sort of classic ideas of what happens to someone who challenges forces beyond his power.
Because you tell us quite clearly in the title that there is no God here.
Well, godless is more meant in the sense of if God can be seen as an attempt to, you know, place order upon the universe, then it's godless in the sense that there is no order to the universe, it's random. So it could have been called Wonders of a Random World or Wonders of a Purposeless World. That's what I was thinking with godless, rather than making any specific sort of statement about God. You know, it's not really meant to be an atheist sort of tome.
No, well, I guess it doesn't, I would say... I mean, it reads like a parable in many ways, but there's no moral message at the
end. No, well, not that I'm aware of, no. And the whole fairy tale sound, I think that wasn't something I necessarily set out to do, but because the orphan can't speak and can't handle the concept of name, so you never know where you are. She doesn't know the name of her town or island or anything, and so the reader never finds out either. So it even with, you know, as I was writing it, it became more and more detached from the real world and took on a fairy tale tone because it has none of the everyday touchstones that a normal novel would have. So you are lost in this sort of mythical, timeless, locationless place. But that was more a side effect. I hadn't set out to write that. But once I realised what's happening, I happily went along with it and sort of went for the whole mythic feel.
And it suits your purpose of originally trying to start out with a novel where the characters are elemental forces rather than...
So it did have to be a sort of a timeless, distant, epic sort of feel to it. Yeah.
And you mentioned fairy tales, and it does have a fairy tale quality, but very much in the Grimm's fairy tale, the Bluebeard's Castle fairy tale, there's some pretty strong stuff in here too.
Yeah, and certainly not a happy ending. But that's the glory of, you know, of the good old fairy tales, is that they're very grim, quite scary, and they don't always make sense or have a moral that sort of is teachable. You know, people die weird deaths in those sort of fairy tales and get punished for not doing anything. And that's what makes them great, because, you know, you don't need things to make sense or to have order for them to be entertaining or to sort of touch some nerve deep down. So
the novel has some ecstatic moments. I would say as a reader, like, for example, when the foreigner and the orphan travel up beyond the atmosphere, from where the orphan can see the curve of the earth, she can see the planet spinning, she can feel its momentum and its weight.
And this is for a person who didn't even know there was a planet. I mean, her consciousness hasn't gone past the fact of her hospital in her small town, and she's vaguely aware of the island she lives on, but that's it. She has no concept that there's a world or other countries or anything. So to be taken up and shown not only that there's this vast world, but that it's round and that it's spinning, things that she's never even thought of before, it's like, to write that is a lot of fun, because it's like you get to discover it all again for yourself as well. All these things that we do take for granted that we all know from, you know, grade 3 in school, basically, but to actually discover them when you had no concept they existed, and to be the first person, as far as she's known, she's the first and only human to know this. So it's incredibly revelationary for her. And it's a lot of fun to write that yourself, because you get to sort of think, well, what would that be like? You know?
Well, and that's where the wonder comes in the title, The Wonders of the Goddess World. And you need your character, your orphan, to be naive and ignorant in order to make the wonder work, don't
you? Yes, that's right. That's right. That was, again, part of the advantage of her having no connection with the rest of humanity. She is this isolated mind with no education. She's never literally learned anything at all apart from what she's seen with her own eyes. And she can't read, TV screens are a blank to her, so she can't even pick up stuff from TV or radio. So she's literally a completely innocent mind that has to sort of work out this very complex stuff on her own, especially when the foreigner starts showing her all this stuff and introducing her to very complex adult conceptions. Mm. She's got nowhere to turn.
And, I mean, for us as readers, it's a reminder to, I mean, we take all this stuff for granted, the fact that we live on a planet that's spinning around and we don't fall off and that there's this vast universe out there and all these other planets and solar systems, and that beneath us is this bubbling magma which occasionally shoots up of volcano spouts and stuff.
That's right.
I mean, we forget how extraordinary the world is.
It is. And like, because, and we all know it, but we don't really know it, of course. We've been told it. Very few of us have seen much with our own eyes or really understand what's happening below the surface of the planet, let alone what's happening in space, because even the experts hardly know what's going on there. So, you know, if any of us had any chance to really confront these things, I think the wonder would come back to everyone. But it's not something we can do, really. So you can't get out of the world easily. You can't just float up into space easily. But it's a lot of fun to do it in a book and let someone, you know, and to let your imagination run wild with that is a great, you know, it's a great chance as a writer to get away to something like that.
Well, you obviously love the science of this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, ever since, you know, I was in school, I've loved all this sort of stuff about, especially weird weather. I have a real obsession with weird weather, more so than these, maybe the sort of geological stuff or the astronomical stuff. But I've longing for a way to get into, you know, to have a character live inside a thunderstorm for a while and be able to write all that was a real dream.
This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm speaking to Andrew McGann about his new novel, Wonders of a Godless World. And Andrew McGann, there's a paradox here too, though, isn't there? Because the book is fabulous. You know, immortal characters who can change the weather with the power of their minds, who can make a volcano spew forth lava, or they can fly into the atmosphere and so on. Yet the natural wonders you're describing, that when you describe the turning of the earth, these are rooted very much in the physical sciences as we understand them.
Yes, and all the strange events that do happen that they witness are all real. Like they're all obscure weather phenomena or strange sort of earthquake type things that don't normally happen. But they're all based on real things, and most of them on real events through history that the foreigner happened to be there for.
So there's a landslide, for example.
The landslide that created it did create the largest natural dam in the world, which is still standing to a state in Russia somewhere. The Ussoy earthquake is hard to say,
but in Kazakhstan or somewhere.
Something like that. And the lake that kills people with its poisonous gas from the bottom. All these are real.
In Africa. I think it's carbon dioxide.
That's right. Bubbles out
of the lake and kills people.
So they're all notifiable events that people that you can check up. But it's important. It was important to root all the fabulous stuff, as you say, back into real science, because otherwise, if they're just floating around out there where they can do anything and nothing, there's no rules that apply to them, then that gets pretty boring fairly fast. You've got to have some reality around fantasy, otherwise it's just made up sort of nonsense really in the end. So for all the weird stuff that goes on, it's always tied back to reality, and they always come back to reality. Wherever they go on their various sort of astral journeys, they always end up back in the hospital, and it's still real life for the orphan in particular. So
there's also a kind of, I suppose, an implicit comparison between the violence of these elemental forces, volcanoes and earthquakes and so on, and the physical violence that humans inflict on each other.
Yeah, it's a whole other realm of the book, really, because there's a lot of violence. I hadn't thought of it in those terms in particular. This seemed to be the natural... Because we haven't really talked about the whole aspect of the book is what the foreigner does to the other characters.
These two, the orphan and the foreigner, travel in this way, there's a price to be paid. And the price is paid by these other inmates near him, the witch.
That's right, because in a sense they travel by examining the madness of these other four patients and by stirring around inside the mind of these other four patients and by sort of... And the result of that is they sort of really exacerbate the madness in these other four and send them off into frenzies, which mostly end violently and very unpleasantly. And that's sort of the price. That's merely there meant to be there as a sign that the foreigner, for all his wisdom and for all that he offers the orphan, there is a price to be paid. And they're not paying it yet. He's being paid by these other four.
The Faust comes back in here.
So the violence there is just sort of, it's just inevitable, really, from what the foreigner's doing to them.
But are you saying that violence is inevitable? That the violence that humans inflict on each other is like a kind of elemental process?
That wasn't really what I was thinking. No. I was sticking more just with the drama itself, saying that there has to be a result from what the foreigner is doing to these people. And the result is, it's just that their madness gets so exacerbated that ugly things are going to happen. And that was more just a sign that it was more about the foreigner, about his lack of interest in other human beings. Mm. It's only the planet that he cares about, and his fascination is with the planet. Humans are irrelevant to him. So that's more the point of it, really, that they're just other living beings, apart from the orphan, are beneath his notice.
And that raises, I suppose, the point of all this, for me, the point of the novel, is this question of, is there a point? The most fundamental of all questions, I guess, what's it all for? Why are there these processes? I mean, at one point the foreigner ponders, is the world just mindless? Is it organisms and chemicals? Or do we actually give it meaning by our existence and our perception of it? We create the beauty because we perceive the beauty.
These are the questions. I mean, I wouldn't say the book's trying to answer them. It's just raising them, saying, well, how do you relate with the planet? He's forced to try and relate with the planet because it keeps killing him and he keeps wondering why. So he over his... not many lives, he tries all different sort of philosophies and different approaches to how mankind should interact with the planet, relate to it. Should we just exploit it because we own it? Should we worship it as some sort of like God? Should we... all these different things that he tries. None of them really work for him or give him an answer. And I guess I was saying that the same myself. Thinking through all the ways that we can interact with the planet, I'm still not sure which one really makes sense. But I'm certainly suspicious of giving consciousness to the planet. So I worry about that. And so I share the foreigner's doubt that is it really more than just chemical processes? I'm not sure that it is. For all that we instinctively seem to think that it is, I'm not convinced that we should.
Well, in fact, I think, some people have read a kind of ecological parable here about global warming and so on. I didn't. I mean, for me, you're making us think and pose these questions for ourselves and struggle with these questions rather than giving us answers.
Certainly nothing to do with global warming. I wasn't thinking of any... There was not meant to be any ecological statement about it.
I didn't perceive that. But people could equally take it the other way. The global warming denialists could see in your book, when we look at ourselves in the scale of geologic time, when we look at these amazing forces that drive the planet and weather systems, we are so puny. We can't really be having any effect.
It's very true. And that is one. That is a conclusion the foreigner seems to make, really, that, that human life is so pitiful against all these things, or any sort of life, that life in general is not really the point of the planet, so it doesn't really matter what happens with it. Again, that's one of his observations. It's not one of mine particularly, or one that I'm trying to say. But because, like, he literally goes through everything. You know, he takes sort of a greeny point of view at one point. That doesn't work for him. He takes the opposite, and that doesn't really work for him. He tries to be indifferent to the planet, forget about it, and it won't let him do that, which is true. I mean, we can't forget the planet. Whatever we decide about it, it dominates us. It's what gives us. It's how we exist. So we can never ignore it. That's the one thing we can't do.
The other question you raise is the other kind of big philosophical question, if I can say, is about the nature of madness and the nature of consciousness. Because you open the possibility that this is actually all just in the orphan's head.
The orphan, again, just by default of what she is, she raises interesting ideas about consciousness anyway. Because she's never spoken to another human being in her life, she has no concept of even first person. No, she's never used the word I or you. She thinks of herself in third person because she's never interacted with someone else, which is strange. As I was writing, thinking, how odd is that? That if you had never had to have a conversation, you'd have no use for terms like I. Your self-awareness would be very different. And so it goes on from there. But I wouldn't say that I'm making a real serious study of madness. It's storybook madness.
No, not a story. No, I wouldn't mean that either. But I suppose you open the possibility that the world only exists in our consciousness.
Ah, well, certainly the book is not meant to. It's meant to be open whether any of this really happens, of course. I mean, whether it's all just imagined in the orphan's head or not, that's certainly meant to be open, and I wouldn't want to push it either way in terms of making someone decide. But, again, that's as far as I thought
of it. But if it did all happen in the orphan's head, then it could all just be happening in our heads. That's
well, that's
true.
Again, I wasn't sort of thinking specifically of that. I was thinking just for the sake of the story, that ambiguity has to be there.
Yeah.
And also because I love writing all the fantastic stuff, but I don't think it's in me to say this really happened. I've always got to have the out where it could all just be a dream sort of thing.
This is the book show. This is the book show on ABC Radio National. I'm speaking to Andrew McGann about his novel, Wonders of a Godless World. Now, all the reviews I've read of the novel have made the point that you as a writer have moved across genres from your first novel, Praise, and its prequel, 1988, which were described as grunge, to the Bjelke-Petersen era political crime novel, Last Drinks, to the political satire, kind of angry political satire, Underground, about the Howard era, I guess, and your Miles Franklin Award-winning novel, The White Earth. Do you set out to cross genres and mix
no,
it up?
No. It's a reputation I'm uneasy about as well, because I'm not sure it's a good thing to be seen as someone who's just flitting across genres all the time.
A flash in the pan in every style.
Yeah, like, what was it? Jack of all trades, master of none sort of thing. No, it's not deliberate. The style seemed to come, as you're thinking about a story and the characters, they seem to define the style in themselves. So, with the exception of Last Drinks, where I did, only because I couldn't write, I had trouble writing anything after the first two books. And so I thought, well, I'll write something. I'll write a crime novel. So that was the only time I decided to definitely go for a genre. All the other books just came out naturally. And this one in particular, the content really decides the style. The state of the orphan's mind, and the fact that it's about things like the elemental forces of the planet, that's the only tone you could really take. It wasn't sort of any other way I could write it.
Do you see, though, continuities between your different novels?
I do, within the characters. And other people have pointed this out. I do seem to have a liking for the main characters to be very passive and relatively innocent characters that everyone acts around.
Things happen to them
They are in the end forced to act, but very reluctantly. And that seems to be obvious, that all the books seem to follow that pattern roughly. The Orphan is probably more dynamic than most of them because she is quite active in the end. I don't know why that is, but I know when I read books, I have trouble believing characters who are resourceful and can do everything and know when to act and act, accordingly. I find that dull to read. So inevitably, I seem to go for the reverse sort of character. Otherwise, I'm not aware of any too many ongoing themes.
I mean, the weather's an ongoing theme, I suppose because, Underground begins with a cyclone.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's
1988, your character is watching the weather.
Indeed.
Observing the weather.
Well, I mean, it is a passion of my own, the weather. So I guess that comes in whenever I get the chance to put it in there.
I mean, the other link, I guess, is what might be called the bluntness, or one critic anyway, is called the bluntness of your writing. It's a a plain style and at times quite graphic, I suppose.
It's funny. I mean, I certainly would agree that the early books were that. They were very simple and very blunt. I would have thought this sort of writing was getting pretty flowery in this new one. But I again, I'm not consciously aware of trying to keep it blunt or of not trying to make it sort of more sort of explorative. But for me, this was really going to town with this sort of writing. So I thought I was probably getting a bit too high blown a lot of the time. But if it comes across as blunt, I don't mind that. I don't take that as a problem or anything. But I am surprised that it still comes across as blunt.
What are the influences on you? Where are you? You know, what leads you to write in terms of, do you begin from other fiction?
I have with other books. The early books were certainly sort of, I was emulating other sort of styles. But lately, and certainly with this one, I can't think of any particular novel or influence that I would say this would go back to. These days I don't read much fiction. I mean, I tend to read nonfiction if I go into a bookshop or a library. I'll go to those shelves first and not often get past them. So I'm sort of out of the loop, really, with what's happening in sort of contemporary fiction. So I don't know where this fits in or whether it's following certain paths or not. So I'm not sure where the ideas come from, and I really don't, think too much about it. I just sit around and thinking, well, it's time to write another book. What's in your head and what do you feel like writing about at that given time? And that sort of just take it from there.
And so, I mean, given that you've, as I say, you've ranged across genres and style, do you see where the next book is going yet?
Yeah. It's. I won't say too much about it, but it is. It is in a genre, which I haven't done before. So
you're going to hop genres again? What's left? Romance.
Yeah, I'm not going. People keep telling me to write a romance. The first book was romance. Praise was a romance.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I won't say, but it's
historical fiction. I'm guessing that.
I'm not going to say anymore. But no. I mean, I'm enjoying it. And again, it wasn't a deliberate thing. The story came up that way. And
so the story is what drives it.
It seems to be. It's like, something you get keen on something, you want to write about it, and character then comes into it somehow. And by that stage, the style has already been defined for you in a way.
The publishers, your publishers, Alan and Unwin, have produced a kind of 2-minute video clip for your novel. It's more like a film trailer than your average promotion for a book.
I had no idea this sort of stuff happened, but apparently it's quite a big thing, trailers for books. But I had no idea. I mean, I assume it's all done by the guy to the cover, and it's a very nice cover.
It's a kind of it's like a little animation that's kind of takes the front cover, which is a very beautiful cover, and turns it into this little film.
The first I knew about it was when it suddenly was on YouTube. Someone said, "Hey, look at this," and I had no idea it was even coming.
And what did you think of it as a way of promoting the book?
I don't know. I have no idea how it works as a marketing thing, but I actually liked the look of it. I didn't know that I would. I thought, no, I'm not sure what I think of this, but watching it through Rexy, it's really quite nicely done. I don't know who actually would go to YouTube and look up things like that. But
no, neither do I. I mean, I've watched it before I finished the book. I'd started the book, but I think it's a bit of false advertising, really, because it comes.
I had looked at it once. What does it say?
It just takes kind of the cover blurb and tells the basic story of The Foreigner and the Orphan. Yep. But it comes across as a much gentler story than your novel actually delivers, I think. So
I'll have to look at it again, actually. I hadn't really thought. It's a whole other world. The marketing of books, I don't know. I never know how that's going to go. And I'm happy to leave it to the publishers. They know more about it than me. So,
Well, Andrew McGowan, thank you very much for joining us here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National.
A pleasure, Peter. Thank you very much.
And Andrew McGowan's book is called Wonders of a Godless World, and it's published by Allen & Unwin. Andrew, of course, is also the author of several other novels, Praise, 1988, Underground, Last Drinks, which is the crime novel, political crime thriller set in Bjelke Petersen era, and the Miles Franklin award-winning The White Earth. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National.